Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. This is Malcolm X weekend. We want to wish him a happy birthday. And we have on the show as our first guest Michael Lange, who is actor, director, and filmmaker, and Crescenda Jenkins. And both of them are on the air to talk about this really wonderful encore production of The Expulsion of Malcolm X, a wonderful play that had a wonderful run in San Francisco, and now it's going to be in the East Bay at Laney College starting May 23rd. Is that right, Michael?
That's correct. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So before I read your bios, why don't we talk a little bit about Brother Malcolm, as he is affectionately known. And what birthday would it be for him? His birthday is actually May 19th, but in the throughout the community college district, and I think it's kind of unprecedented, Malcolm X's birthday is honored by the entire throughout the community college district closing. So today, the 16th, is the day that is Malcolm X Day in the Peralta Community College District and the day that people are home and not working. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Brother Malcolm, Michael, since you are, besides being an actor, director, filmmaker, best known for your portrayal of Malcolm X, Alistair Willis specifically. And it's so interesting, like in this play, instead of playing Brother Malcolm and directing as you did for the play's world premiere, you actually are playing Elijah Muhammad, Brother Malcolm's mentor, and almost served as like a father figure for him.
Yes. Well, Brother Malcolm would be 89 So he was born on May 19th, of course, in 1925. That's actually the same year my mother was born, and she's 89, so that way I can keep up with Brother Malcolm. I have had a few people who had the same birthday that will come on Monday, certainly at different ages, but I'm always resonating with people who are in the month of May, particularly around Malcolm. But I've had the pleasure of traveling across this nation, been in many states portraying Malcolm X and doing what they would call delineation, the cadence of Malcolm X, his ballot or the bullet speech, and his message to the grassroots. And I've done them probably somewhere between 800 and 1,000 times. And usually just on weekends, flying around different parts, New York City, and I've been to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and upstate Seattle, Washington, and down south in Atlanta. So I've seen the, I remember I started in 1990, so I started prior to Spike Lee's film, and as I started getting more and more opportunities to perform, the film came out, and certainly by 1993, I think the film came out, I was really riding the crest of the public sentiment. They were saying, wow, this is really good. And it was a fad of a sort in that what was happening is the X clothing, everybody would come to a performance similar here to the Paramount Theater, but this was in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was amazing to see this. And then about 6 or 7 months later, the clothing just disappeared out of a lot of the performances that I was in. So I've had a good run. I think it would be 24 years I've been doing Malcolm. And finally, at age 65, and certainly Malcolm passed away at age 39, it was time for me to step aside and to allow a young man, his name is DeJuan Connor, and he stepped into the shoes, and he was doing a tremendous job. The vitality, the energy, the cadence, the mannerisms that he brings as Malcolm X just delights me, and I feel good. And he had asked if I would play the mentor to Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad. So I said, yes, I would.
Wow. Yeah, I know when I first met you a long time ago, you were doing Brother Malcolm or Hajj Malik El Shabazz, as, you know, a one-man performance, and then later on, I saw you and James. What's James's last name?
Brooks. James Brooks.
James Brooks. Yeah, you all would do the meeting, which is, you know, the fictional meeting between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., and that's a really wonderful piece. And who's the writer, the playwright for that particular piece?
That's Jeff Stetson. He's a playwright in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Very
fine writer. I don't know how he would. I would only want to do verbatim educational things. And somebody brought me the script, the meeting, and I said, "Well, is this true?" And he says, "No, it's not. It's a fictionalized meeting between Dr. King and Malcolm." So I said, "Well, I'd like to do what really was stated in history." And when I read the play, though, I couldn't believe how much history this writer had captured of both Malcolm X and Martin, and then put it into a conversation between the two as if it actually took place. So I've done that quite a bit around the country, beginning in 1997, right up until, probably up until about a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another historic character you portrayed a lot, you and James, again, that wonderful collaboration of black men, actors, directors here in the San Francisco Bay Area, was the one on Frederick Douglass. And then, you know, doing the What to an American Slave is the 4th of July at Angela Wellman's at her
The Music Academy,
Yes, exactly. And that, you know, like you just start these things and they just become, you know, sort of annual rituals, so to speak, you know, in honoring our ancestors. And so with the expulsion of Malcolm X, written by Larry Amrick Allen and directed by you, which begins on Friday, May 23rd at 7:30, is the East Bay premiere at Laney College Theater, 900 Fallon Street. And it continues Saturday the 24th, 7:30, Thursday, May 29th at 7:30, Friday the 30th, and then Saturday and Sunday the 31st. It has two performances at 2:30 and 7:30, and that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, there won't be any Sunday performances, but there will be two on Saturday, the 20th.
Right.
The 31st, May 31st.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll really be digging down to get that energy to get those two performances on the same day. It's a classic play. It's probably 2.5 hours. So when you add a 15-minute intermission, It almost is about 3 hours. It's about 3 hours and 2 or 3 minutes. And it's a beautiful production. And we will have a folk talk where we will give Q&A with the actors and the playwright at the Saturday 2:30 matinee performance.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be both on the 24th and the 31st?
Just the 31st.
Okay.
Because that's an afternoon. We would be at Laney until midnight if we did it on the 24th, because we start at 7:30. We'll probably get out about, say, 10:30, and that's pretty late at night. So we did want to have a Q&A period, so we'll have it on the 31st.
Okay, excellent. And so for those who saw the world premiere, we probably caught Crescenda Jenkins portraying Betty X, but if you missed her, you have an opportunity to see her again. So Crescenda, you describe yourself as a thespian at heart, and that you've always had a passion for performing arts. You started acting on stage at the age of 15, and although you took a hiatus for some time, you're back and ready to play again your role as Sister Betty. In the expulsion of Malcolm X. And so why don't you tell us about Sister Betty, as well as about this play, which is, I believe, it's epic, because Amrick is such a fine writer, and he just puts so much history. It's so dense. But your Sister Betty is like, oh, my God. I mean, people know Sister Betty Shabazz, you know, Malcolm X's partner, was a phenomenal woman. However, we don't really know how phenomenal she is until you sort of, you know, breathe life into this character. and perform, you know, this particular role in a way that people are like sitting back like, wow, oh my goodness, this woman, like, so wonder, you know, Hajj Malik chose her as his life partner.
I really love her. I love the being of Betty Shabazz, Betty X. She was, not only was Malcolm prolific, she was in her own right. She was a strength, a silent strength during his time. And then after his death, she became very vocal. And you were able to see the strength of this being and to see why they were such a team. And it was, I tell people this all the time, that it was hard to, it's hard to play her role, to feel the emotion, or the at least the emotion that I feel that she felt being his wife, because there was always a fear that he may pass, you know. And when it happened, oh, I could just imagine the pain that she went through. But she's a beautiful being. She ended up raising all her children on her own, and she was so intelligent and had so much passion for his struggle. So I just feel very privileged to be able to play this role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how did you come to be cast in this particular role?
I went out and I auditioned, and luckily I got the role.
Yeah, I remember her audition. She was bringing, I guess it's the it factor, they call it now, but she's bringing an energy of vitality. And that's why when she mentioned she was a thespian, I mean, that she truly goes into the emotion and the passion and then the intelligence, all of that is in the mix. And she clearly stood out among the other people who were auditioning that day. And so I was happy that she said, yes, I'd like to be in the production when we offered her that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a blessing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
To be
and Michael,
the team.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Michael, you, you know, as you mentioned, you know, that you've been performing the role of Malcolm X for, gosh, I mean, that's going back, you said...
1990.
Yeah, 1990. That's a long time. And
it was,
you know,
May 19th. It was May 19th. It was on Malcolm's birthday
really?
That I first performed it.
Oh, amazing. Wow, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's just... And you've... you know, it's like that is just that's amazing. And then, you know, we already mentioned, you know, the play that you and James Brooks performed in, but you've also directed two award-winning plays, Ceremonies and Dark Old Men, which received the Best Play Award, and The Old Settler, where you received Best Director. And you premiered Ed Ballou's work, Another Depression, in the role of the human isotope in 2010. And you wrote the play Prophet Nat, and I remember that. That had a wonderful Oakland, California world premiere, and that was really phenomenal. It's a musical musical docudrama based on the life of the slave, formerly enslaved Prophet Nat Turner. No, actually, I think he was still enslaved when he was still enslaved when he led the rebellion. And now you're on the faculty at San Jose State University, where you've taught since 1998, and you continue to write and perform for stage and film, and you live in Oakland. I was wondering, Michael, if you could talk, and also you, Crescenda, if you could talk about, you know, some of your favorite, favorite scenes or lines or aspects of the play. But Michael, why don't you talk about sort of, you know, embodying Elijah Muhammad? How is that? How's that coming along?
He does an awesome job, by the way.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Crescenda. That role of Elijah is probably opposite of Malcolm, meaning the amount of power, the cadence, the charisma of a Malcolm X. It was obvious that he had these incredible ideas. His mind, you could see as Malcolm, it was just going so fast, and he would look at his audience and he would tell that audience wherever it was, whether it was outdoors at New York in Harlem, or whether it was at the at Harvard University. He would look to see who was out there, and somehow he could dial you up and tell you exactly what you needed to hear. With Elijah, it's actually a different cadence, and it's a timing where he had asthma. He was sickly. He was soft-spoken. He had a third-grade education. So it's the opposite of what I think Malcolm was doing. That's what I'm finding. So the actor's job is to find the melody, the comfort zone, and the rhythm of the character. And I have to go in, which I did as Malcolm. I went in as Michael in search of Malcolm. My director, her name was Gloria Weinstock. She told me, she says, don't bring me Malcolm. And this was in the play, The Meeting. She says, you bring me Michael. And that's how we will find Malcolm. I said, wow, that was a circuit that she knew about. So with Elijah, who has dialogue with other characters and is not just standing at a podium, and speaking to an audience, he's speaking to other members of the Food of Islam. He's interacting with his son, Wallace Muhammad. So now I have to go into ensemble with a kind of a humility, and the way people speak in the South back in the 30s and the 20s when Elijah was a young man, and coming into the 60s, he's 65 years old. I'm 65 years old, so anyway, all I have to do now is just study this man's life and find out how I can bring sincerity and integrity to a life that he lived. And that's what I did with Malcolm X. And so I'm starting to dial him up, still have some rough edges to polish. But I will, once I get that, you know, the clothing on, the lights are up, and the moment of truth shows up on stage, that's when I think I will find Elijah. And he may be different nights too. I mean, because I'm rehearsing with myself right now, and I'm saying, wow, that was different than what I did last week. So he is evolving, and I don't know where he's going, but I'm going to try to stay up with him and just bring honor to his role. He had a tough, what they call a tough row to hoe. He had to make some moves, and one of the big things was his extramarital affairs, which became known in the press, but not that well known, and he had these other children, and I said, well, why would he do that? And it was really, to me, the next generation of Muhammad. See, his wife could not bring him children. At age, she was probably 63 or 64, somewhere in there. So he had these other children, and these children are alive today. And so I wanted to bring all of this mix into the theatrical piece that Amrick originally intended. And I think Amrick is happy with the interpretation, but I still see a whole lot more in terms of exploration of that particular character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Crescenda, why don't you talk about, I mean, there are a lot of dynamics happening in this particular piece, The Expulsion. And why don't you talk about some of the real, tense or intense moments in the piece, you know, with your role as Sister Betty, and what you see, you know, your partner experiencing with regards to, you know, his development as a Muslim, and not necessarily a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you know, as you know, Brother Malcolm sort of grows in his understanding of what it means to be a Muslim and what it means to be a black leader and what it means to be a revolutionary, and also sort of his commitment to his family and you know, his wife and his child and or children and then his siblings, his brother who brought him into the Nation of Islam, and that tension there, and then, you know, sort of his ethical and his moral values and how that's being challenged, you know, and, you know, sort of like it's a whole lot happening in that household.
Yeah.
And it seems like, and your particular character, which is really different, it wasn't in the movie, how, you know, you drop out hints to Brother Malcolm, the character, and he listens to you.
Mm-hmm. It, first Emmerich wrote a beautiful piece. It's a masterpiece. And the beauty is that, you know, there are all these internal struggles that we're all going through. And for Malcolm, my husband, it's the fact that he, in so many ways, adores Mr. Muhammad, and he has so much loyalty to him that there's so many signs that and he's not paying attention to the signs because he doesn't want to believe them. And for me, being his wife and the one who loves him, I try to tell him, you know, about these signs and try to tell him about what's going on. And at first, he doesn't want to listen because he's developing as a world leader. He's developing in his religion. And he just hearing this at this moment or hearing that at that moment would just be so hurtful to him. And so that's one of the biggest intense moments to me in the play is when I finally just tell him, you know, something is going on. You have to pay attention to what you're listening, what you're seeing. Listen to the signs. You have to pay attention. And that's what makes him go a little further to do some more research. And that's when he finds out the truth. And it hurts him to his heart because what he finds out is something that, you know, I don't want to tell too much of the play, but what he finds out is something that affects him because it ties back to what happened with him and his brother and the decision that he had to, you know, decide with his brother. So one of my favorite lines in the play is "Pain is private," because Betty is going through her own internal pain. She doesn't articulate that pain because she wants to be strong. But her fear of losing her husband, her fear with the death threats, her fear with him being in the limelight, she goes through her own internal struggle. So it's a beautiful work of art, and we have so many gems in it. So I'm very excited about it being performed again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, Michael, favorite parts of the play, you don't have to necessarily be in them, or pieces or parts that are really difficult to be in or to direct?
Yeah, well, as a director of the last year's world premiere and now being in this production, we realized early on that I needed a director for me as Elijah. And that's not, you know, strange or anything else. It's you realize that you're wearing two hats. And so I'm fortunate to have Gerald Wright and Larry Amrick Allen to help me in this role. And they take on the other parts of the cast when I'm in a scene. So we're doing it by committee practically this way, and it really helps because the amount of, I wouldn't say it was pressure, but it's the intensity of the moments, being in character. How do you get out of that character and then become the director? So what I do at the end, of course, is I collect my thoughts for notes to the actors. And, you know, the other day I wrote a little note to everybody, you know, as a director. And so the big thing is for me to get the character. The play can stand on its own. I mean, even if we sat in the round, what we call a read-through, and we just read this with our memorizing our lines, it would still have an impact. But now we're putting the clothing on, we're putting it on its legs, and then we have different scenes in Harlem, New York, or in Chicago. And so what I need is somebody to give me some feedback in terms of, no, you may want to look at this. And so Amrick has really keyed in. He wrote this play in 1985. He's seeing some nuances now, some for the first time, that he originally intended in 1985 when he wrote it. And these little things smooth out in relationship to this charismatic Malcolm and to Wallace Muhammad, begin to make this play stand for, you know, it's been, what, 30 years right now. It could go another 30 or 40 years, which is the test of a playwright in terms of a classic? Can it make it to 50 years, or is the theme so temporal that it can only last for a season or for 2 or 3 years? So I'm fortunate to have that. There are many great lines in this production. Even the throwaway lines have tremendous impact. Mm-hmm. There was a scene where Elijah is telling Malcolm that he is his best friend. And it may seem insignificant, but when you see this conspiracy developing around Malcolm by the Nation of Islam trying to find a reason to expel Malcolm out of the nation, and the reason that they gave was this chicken's coming home to roost. And we see this interchange between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, where Elijah is like his father, like Malcolm's father, and he tells him, you know, yes, I am your best friend. And what that signaled to me, that even through the expulsion of Malcolm X, that Elijah still loved Malcolm as a son, and probably more, loved him more than his own sons. And he says as much in one of the soliloquies or one of the monologues that Elijah has. It's just a tremendous thing. So I could go into any character, Wallace Muhammad confronting his father with this hypocrite stuff that Elijah has been doing. And Elijah challenges his son. He says, what did you mean about that hypocrite stuff? And Wallace turns to him. He says, what did you think I meant? And it's just powerful. Bottom lines, you know, this is the payoff line or the money lines. There are many, many of them. And the way Amrick wrote it, I think he gives every character a moment on stage where they get a chance to push their craft or to shape it and to be part of a larger wheel. So we bring our little spokes into the bigger wheel, and then what we see is the entire car or the entire wheel as it rolls through Laney College as a kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, I was just wondering if both of you, sort of in our closing minutes, could talk about sort of the relevance of Malcolm X. You say that that he will be, his birthday anniversary, he would have been 90. 89. Yeah, next year will be 90th. Birthday anniversary, and Malcolm X, you know, he was a part of the civil rights movement, and you think about, you know, sort of key iconic figures during that period that, you know, sort of came in, you know, sort of like a comet, and just lit up everything, and then, you know, like comets, they, you know, they their effect lingers because you see the tail, but they're gone, and of all of the, like, you think about El Hajj, I mean, you think about Martin Luther King Jr., you know, another brilliant man who was, you know, killed at 39. Malcolm X has like an international reputation that, you know, the young folks are still talking about. You know, they're still wearing T-shirts. You know, you travel around the world, and they remember Brother Malcolm. So what is it about Malcolm X that resonates, you know, so powerfully with today's youth, presently, you know, in this country and elsewhere? What is it about him that has that impact? I mean, quite a few things about him. You know, you could mention, but what would you like to mention?
Well, I'd like to mention that Malcolm was the people's champion. It's kind of like Muhammad Ali, the boxer, transcends boxing, and he goes into the world community. And people felt an energy out of Malcolm, and that energy was probably his sincerity and his truth. And that's what shows up for a lot of people, even today. More so, there's been more books written on Malcolm X 25 years after his death than there were in the first, say, 20 years of his death. So that tells you something, that he is resonating in the world community. And he's looked upon as a Pan-Africanist, a black nationalist, a Muslim. And talking to Atala Shabazz, she says, and I see him as my father. And a lot of people miss that. She witnessed him being assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom at 6 years old, and so she saw her daddy being killed. So that whole civil rights stuff, that matrix going into that, and I lived through it. I was about 16 years old when Malcolm X was assassinated, and 19 when Dr. King was assassinated. So I lived through that. But Malcolm X was after a truth, and that's what transcends the Nation of Islam and Malcolm's life. He was after the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth with his life. And what Amr did is he caught it almost in a Shakespearean format, because the lines are so tremendous. And that's how I see Malcolm X and what this play means today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Krishinda, your comments.
For me, I'm in love with Malcolm X. And I think that the older I've gotten, because when I was younger, of course, when you're in school, you don't get as much knowledge about Malcolm X until you get, you know, older and you are able to research it on your own. And I love his authenticity. And he loved black people. He loved our struggle. And he loved it so much that he sacrificed for us. He fought for us, and he believed in our strength as a people. And like Michael said, he was so he had so much authenticity. And he died for that. He died for his truth and the truth of our people. And I feel like sometimes we don't remember him with as much respect as we should. Always respect what he did for us, and have that love for him. And I will always have that love for him in my heart.
Yeah, excellent. So why don't we give our audience the details again about the East Bay premiere of this wonderful play, The Expulsion of Malcolm X. Colors of Vision Entertainment is presenting it, Cove. And why don't we give a little plug for Cove, Michael?
Sure. Well, Cove, C-O-V-E,
sorry.
And it stands for Color of Vision, or Colors of Vision Entertainment. And it's been a company put together by Duane Connor. I think his love for Malcolm X is only surpassed by Crescenda's love for Malcolm X. And we will be at Laney College May 23rd. That's a Friday, this coming Friday, a week from today. Saturday, May 24th. Both of those shows will be at 7:30. And then the following week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we have shows at 7:30 with a matinee at 2:30 on Saturday, May 31st, the closing day. So that's the best way to get tickets is brownpapertickets.com. They're $35 online. You can also purchase tickets at the door. We do have a phone number if you'd like to make a telephone call. It would be in the 650 area code, 776-5838. So we have six performances. We have a nice house at Laney College. It holds about 300 people. So we can get close to 1,500 to 1,800 people here on the East Bay side to come and be a fly on the wall, so to speak, in the Nation of Islam and in the House of Malcolm, as we see this play develop towards its conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent, excellent. And I believe you told me in an email that we actually could offer some of our listeners a pair of tickets. Did I remember that correctly? Okay.
Yes, you did. That was good. Yeah, we can certainly, to our audience and to yourself, we certainly would offer tickets. Ideally, right now we have opening night tickets. That's Friday, May 23rd. I think it's very important to have a big house opening night because then there'll be witnesses, ear witnesses and eyewitnesses, and then they can tell folks if they come the next day. And some people have come twice to see the production. There's a lot of stuff in the play, so I can understand that. But we certainly would have some tickets for you and your audience, and maybe as you continue to do your show, you can give some tickets away for next weekend if you'd like.
Oh, certainly. That'd be super. So, folks, if you're interested in a pair of tickets for opening night, how exciting.
Yeah.
That means you're going to get a chance to meet the playwright and the cast because they come out and hang out and take pictures, and it's really exciting. Oh, that's great. Yeah, so just shoot me a blog post for the radio show.
Yeah, if they call into your show, for example, you can just call us or call the 650-776-5838 or call me, and I will have their name at the door. Since we're about a week away, we could send tickets if we get something, say, by Monday, but we can back it up with a will call at the door. And we can go, you know, maybe three pairs of tickets or four pairs of tickets and give that to your guests.
Oh, that's awesome. So what's the phone number again, Michael? 350?
Yeah. You know, it's a 650.
650. Yes.
Yes. 776-5838.
Mm-hmm.
Or brownpapertickets.com.
Brownpapertickets.com. Okay, excellent. Well, I will let you know who those lucky folks are. Well, I was hoping to speak to Marvin X about the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival, which is this weekend.
Yes.
But, yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to get him in the studio to talk a little bit about that. So we're going to go out with a wonderful piece by Leon Thomas called Malcolm's Gone, and then maybe we'll play something from one of his recorded speeches or debates to sort of bring his voice into the studio for this wonderful morning, you know, conversation and maybe sort of like just a little tribute since we don't have a show on Monday, his actual 89th birthday.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us guest on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great having you, Michael and Crescenda, and I look forward to seeing you in the theater next week.
Yes, we
can't
will
wait.
Be ready for opening night.
Right, okay. Well, you all take good care, and thank you again so much for joining us.
Okay, thank
you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Peace.
Bye.
El Haj Malik Shabazz. Yes, Malcolm. but he's not forgotten. He died to save me. died to save me. Gave me my dignity.
Mr. Chairman, tonight is the first night that I've ever had an opportunity to be as near to conservatives as I am. And the speaker who preceded me, first I want to thank you for the invitation to come here to the Oxford. And the speaker who preceded me, first I want to thank you for the invitation to come here to the Oxford Union. The speaker who preceded me is one of the best excuses that I know to prove our point concerning the necessity sometimes of extremism in defense of liberty, why it is no vice, and why moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. I don't say that about him personally, but that type is the... He's right. X is not my real name. But if you study history, you'll find why no black man in the Western Hemisphere knows his real name. Some of his ancestors kidnapped our ancestors from Africa and took us into the Western Hemisphere and sold us there. And our names were stripped from us, and so today we don't know who we really are. I'm one of those who admit it, and so I just put X up there to keep from wearing his name. And as far as this apartheid charge that he attributed to me is concerned, evidently he has been misinformed. I don't believe in any form of apartheid. I don't believe in any form of segregation. I don't believe in any form of racialism. But at the same time, I don't endorse a person as being right just because his skin is white. And oftentimes when you find people like this, I mean that type, when a man whom they have been taught is below them has the nerve or firmness to question some of their philosophy or some of their conclusions, usually they put that label on us, a label that is only designed to project an image which the public will find distasteful. I'm a Muslim. If there is something wrong with that, then I stand condemned. My religion is Islam. I believe in Allah. I believe in Muhammad as the apostle of Allah. I believe in brotherhood of all men. But I don't believe in brotherhood with anybody who's not ready to practice brotherhood with our people. I don't believe in brotherhood. I just take time to make these few things clear because I find that one of the tricks of the West, and I imagine my good friend, or at least that type is from the West, one of the tricks of the West is to use or create images. They create images of a person who doesn't go along with their views, and they make certain that this image is distasteful, and then anything that that person has to say from there on in, is rejected. And this is a policy that has been practiced pretty well, pretty much by the West. It perhaps would have been practiced by others had they been in power, but during recent centuries, the West has been in power. They've created the images, and they've used these images quite skillfully and quite successfully. That's why today we need a little extremism in order to straighten a very nasty situation out. or a very extremely nasty situation out. I think the only way one can really determine whether or not extremism in defense of liberty is justified is not to approach it as an American or a European or an African or an Asian, but as a human being. If we look upon it as different types, immediately we begin to think in terms of extremism being good for one and bad for another, or bad for one and good for another. But if we look upon it, if we look upon ourselves as human beings, I doubt that anyone will deny that extremism in defense of liberty, the liberty of any human being, is a vice. Anytime anyone is enslaved or in any way deprived of his liberty, that person is a human being. As far as I'm concerned, he is justified to resort to whatever method necessary to bring about his liberty again. But most people usually think in terms of extremism as something that's relative, related to someone whom they know or something that they've heard of. I don't think they look upon extremism as it's by itself or all alone. They apply it to something. A good example, and one of the reasons that this can't be too well understood today, many people who have been in positions of power in the past don't realize that the power, centers of power are changing. When you're in a position of power for a long time, you get used to using your yardstick, and you take it for granted that because you forced your yardstick upon others, that everyone is still using the same yardstick. So that your definition of extremism usually applies to everyone. But nowadays, times are changing, and the center of power is changing. People in the past who weren't in a position to have a yardstick or use a yardstick of their own are using their own yardstick now. You use one, and they use another. In the past, when the oppressor had one stick and the oppressed used that same stick, today the oppressed are sort of shaking the shackles and getting yardsticks of their own. So when they say extremism, they don't mean what you do. And when you say extremism, you don't mean what they do. There's entirely two different meanings. And when this is understood, I think you can better understand why those who are using methods of extremism are being driven to them. A good example is the Congo. When the people who are in power want to use, again, create an image to justify something that's bad, they use the press. And they'll use the press to create a humanitarian image for a devil, or a devil image for a humanitarian. They'll take a person who's the victim of the crime and make it appear he's the criminal, and they'll take the criminal and make it appear that he's the victim of the crime. And the Congo situation is one of the best examples that I can cite right now to point this out. The Congo situation is a nasty example of how a country, because it is in power, can take its press and make the world accept something that's absolutely criminal. They take pilots that they say are American trained, and this automatically lends respectability to them. And then they will call them anti-Cuban, anti-Castro Cubans, and that's supposed to add to their respectability, and eliminate the fact that they're dropping bombs on villages where they have no defense whatsoever against such planes, blowing to bits black women, Congolese children, Congolese babies. This is extremism. But it is never referred to as extremism because it is endorsed by the West. It's financed by America. It's made respectable by America. And that kind of extremism is never labeled as extremism because it's not extremism in defense of liberty. And if it is extremism in defense of liberty, as this text has just pointed out, it's extremism in defense of liberty for the wrong type of people. That kind of extremism. That's cold-blooded murder. But the press is used to make that cold-blooded murder appear as an act of humanitarianism. They take it one step farther and get a man named Shombi, who is a murderer. They refer to him as the premier of the, or the prime minister of the Congo, to lend respectability to him. He's actually the murderer of the rightful prime minister of the Congo. They never mention that this man... for extremism in defense of that kind of liberty or that kind of activity. They take this man who's a murderer. The world recognizes him as a murderer, but they make him the prime minister. He becomes a paid murderer, a paid killer, who is propped up by American dollars. And to show the degree to which he is a paid killer, the first thing he does is go to South Africa and hire more killers and bring them into the Congo. They give them the glorious name of mercenary, which means a hired killer, not someone that's killing for some kind of patriotism or some kind of ideal, but a man who is a paid killer, a hired killer. And one of the leaders of them is right from this country here. And he's glorified as a soldier of fortune when he's shooting down little black women and black babies and black children. I'm not for that kind of extremism. I'm for the kind of extremism that those who are being destroyed by those bombs and destroyed by those hired killers are able to put forth to thwart it. They will risk their lives at any cost. They will sacrifice their lives at any cost against that kind of criminal activity. I'm for the kind of extremism that the freedom fighters in the Stanleyville regime are able to display against these hired killers who are actually using some of my tax dollars that I have to pay up in the United States to finance that operation over there. We're not for that kind of extremism. And again, I think you must point out that the real criminal there is one of those who are very much involved as accessories to the crime is the press. Not so much your press, but the American press, which has tricked your press into repeating what they have invented. I was reading in one of the English papers this morning, I think it's a paper called The Express, and it gave a very clear account of the type of criminal activity that has been carried on by the mercenaries that are being paid by United States tax dollars. And it showed where they were killing Congolese, whether they were from the central government or the Stanleyville government. It didn't make any difference to them. They just killed them. And they had it fixed where those who had been processed had to wear a white bandage around their head, and any Congolese that they saw without that white bandage, they killed them. And this is clearly pointed out in the internet last week. There would have been an outcry, and no one would have allowed the Belgians and the United States and the others who are in cahoots with each other to carry on the criminal activity that it did in the Congo, and which I doubt anybody in the world, not even here at Oxford, will accept, not even my friends. Yes.
I wonder what sort of extremism you would consider the killing of missionaries.
Yeah!
I call it the type of extremism that was involved when America dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and killed 80,000 people, or over 80,000 people, both men, women, children, everything. It was an act of war. I'd call it the same kind of extremism that happened when England dropped bombs on German cities and Germans dropped bombs on English cities. It was an act of war. And the Congo situation is war. And when you call it war, then anybody that dies, they die a death that is justified. But those who are in the Stanleyville regime, sir, are defending their country. Those who are coming in are invading their country. And some of the refugees that were questioned on television in this city a couple of days ago pointed out that had the paratroopers not come in, they doubted that they would have been molested. They weren't being molested.
That is Malcolm X at the Oxford debate, December 3rd, 1964. And we are paying tribute to Malcolm X this morning in our earlier interview with Michael Land and Crescenda with regards to the East Bay debut of The Expulsion of Malcolm X, which is May 23rd, the weekend's May 23rd, continuing the following week, May 29th through Sunday, May 31st at Laney College Theater. So we were playing that particular, I guess, excerpt of one of many interviews of El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, and wanted to remind people that the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival is continuing, which is really wonderful. I believe, see, what anniversary is this of the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival? Let me check. just going, scrolling backwards. this is the 14th annual Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival this weekend, Saturday, tomorrow, May 17th, 11 to 7 p.m. at San Antonio Park in Oakland. It is a free event, and it is just so wonderful. And this year, the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival is paying a special tribute to the great Afro-American revolutionary and poet and activist Amiri Baraka, who made his transition in January this year. And so there are just going to be some wonderful performances, and yeah, you don't want to miss it. It's just a really wonderful event that everyone in the Bay Area just really enjoys. It's just wonderful and fabulous. And we are going to be joined in the studio. I think we are actually joined in the studio by wonderful, wonderful playwright Christina Anderson. Good morning, Christina. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's so great. We've been like ships passing in the daytime for many years, because I am such an admirer of your phenomenal work, your writing. It's just your stories you tell are just so unique and provocative.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, like after I see a Christina Anderson play, I'm just like marked. Yeah, it's like, okay, and I'm just thinking about your play years and years and years, even when they're stage readings, as this one was when I saw Penmanship, which is having its world premiere at the Magic Theater. I guess, is that in the coming weeks, right? Because it's running May 21st in previews, but then it has opening on May 28th. But it's going to have such a nice long run through June 15th.
Yeah.
People can actually come back.
Yeah, and tell their friends and spread the word. Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
I think it'll
be
a good show. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, and in the way the title is written, pen, you know, /man/ship, and each one of those aspects of penmanship, you know, is its own entity. But then there, you know, the stories overlap, you know, in a way only you can do this. Like, how in the heck did you? Maybe we could start before we read your wonderful bio. Just start a little bit about just sort of the name of this word, penmanship, and what's the story, and how did you come to this story?
Oh, well, Penmanship is a play, and the story is set in 1896. And it takes place on a ship that's heading to Liberia. A black man by the name of Charles Boyd, who's a fictitious character, but in the play world, he's a black man land surveyor, and he's been hired by these unknown, unseen white philanthropists to go to Liberia. And in the course of the play, we find out that he's been hired to survey land to start a penal colony, where black men, American men, will be exiled to serve time, much in the same way that Australia had penal colonies back in the day. So he's on the ship with his son, and his son has brought on this mysterious woman who ends up becoming a force within the play. And you just sort of see Charles kind of struggling with his opinion of the crew who we don't see in the play. He was also an all-black crew. And this new relationship with his son, and it all kind of comes to a head. I won't give away the ending because hopefully, you know, it'll be something that, you know, will excite people and get people going. So I want people to come and check out the show. So the whole play takes place on the ship. We never see America or Liberia in the play. We just sort of exist on the Atlantic Ocean. And it's an all-black crew, all black people. One of the crew members that we meet is Cecil, and he's a black man. He plays accordion. So there's accordion music in the play. Let's see, how did I get started with it? Well, when I was in graduate school in a playwriting program at Yale, it started out as a writing assignment from one of my teachers, and we had to write a play that sort of riffed on the Victorian age. And I just started doing research, and then, you know, what is that, Jim Crow became constitutional in 1896. And so I just started doing research around that. And the more that I ventured out from that topic, the more I came across, like, narratives of black people during that time who wanted out of America. They were sick of the political system. They were sick of the oppression. They were seeking all types of other ways to exist in the world. And there was a huge, like, immigration quest and push and thirst to leave America and go to other places. Which I had never known about. I had always heard about people going to Paris, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, and, you know, Marcus Garvey and those kind of pushes. But I had never known that there was sort of this push, like even in the 1890s, to get out of America. So once I started doing that kind of research, it was just a really interesting thing that sort of linked back to our present day, you know, and like the global sort of relationship that African Americans, black Americans have within the diaspora. And I just thought it was a really interesting conversation to try and link between, you know, today and back then. So I just started working on the first draft of the play with all that stuff kind of mixed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I was thinking of sort of the whole thing around, you know, writing and how for enslaved Africans, it was illegal to teach them how to read and write. And notion of you know, keeping journals, and, you know, ships are sort of known for their journals, sort of like airplanes are known for their black boxes. And it's like, oh, there's no black box we can't find, so we don't know what was going on in the pilot's head. And, oh, you know, but, if we have the journal of the captain, or, you know, usually the captain is literate and he's writing. And so think about sort of the whole idea of penmanship. And penmanship was something that when I was a kid, you could get awards for in school, because to have good penmanship was like an art form to be able to write beautifully and well, you know, before, you know, I mean, not calligraphy necessarily, but the penmanship looked like calligraphy, because, you know, all of the tools, you know, you had your quill and you had the ink, and it's like a whole ceremony around the writing process. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of the whole idea of penmanship being sort of like a metaphor, like the whole idea of writing and the ink and the whole ceremony around that, and how, you know, how you sort of explore that perhaps in the work.
Well, the main character that played Charles Boyd, although he isn't the official captain of the ship, he is the one sort of orchestrating this journey across the water. And I knew that I wanted him to sort of have these journals that he kept, because you're right, like a lot of those captains back then, they did sort of keep journals to sort of do archives and kind of prosperity. And Charles as a character is this man who is invested in his legacy. So I knew that I wanted him to write throughout the play. And it was also just a really, you know, like interesting theatrical device to sort of get into the head of Charles, because he is quite distant from some of the other characters in the play. So I'm trying to figure out, like, how do we find out what he's thinking? And then also, too, like at this time, like education was a commodity, you know, and it was a rare one, especially for, like, people of color. And the simple fact that Charles could write and read, as well as his son, as well as everybody in the play, it'd be like they all at some point throughout the play sort of question how they got their education. So this whole notion of penmanship, when the title is sort of read as a single word, it also becomes this metaphor for power. It becomes this metaphor for class. access and just having the ability to sort of, you know, be able to read and write during this time. So that was something I wanted to tap into as well. So, like, when you put the title together, the single word, it sort of takes on this whole notion of, like, education and legacy and archive. And then when you separate it into three separate words, penmanship, you have the literal object of writing with a pen and a quill and just sort of having the writing instrument. Also the penitentiary, sort of pinning people up. And man, there are a lot of men in the play. Yeah, there's only one female character and three men. And they're on a ship. So the title, it was sort of a gold mine when I thought of it because I was like, this is like the simplest way to describe this play, but also it just sort of captures a lot of the metaphor too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And you think about, you know, black people in ships and transport and being moved around most often unwillingly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was thinking about with regards to migrations, you're probably aware since you were, you know, the National New Play Network playwright in residence at the Magic Theater, you know, for 2011. So you were there, you were around a while. So I'm sure you got a chance to meet Joanna Haygood of Zaco Performance Theater, a dance theater, and she actually was commissioned to do a piece looking at the San Francisco Black migration to Canada, and the piece was called Fly Away Home. I'm not sure exactly of the title, but it was performed outdoors on Market Street, and these people, you know, the dancers were embodying characters based on real African American San Franciscans who chartered a ship and left San Francisco because the racism was just too much, and they were business people. And it's like, well, if San Francisco doesn't want us, we can leave.
Yeah,
so they,
yeah.
They charted
out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just sort of thinking about, you know, sort of the Atlantic, you know, slave trade, you know, the European slave trade. And whenever you think about ships and you juxtapose those with people of African descent, you know, you have to go there. And and then the whole thing around Liberia, that was a place, well, after the emancipation, it's like, okay, well, these black folks, we can't work them for free. Let's get rid of them. Like, don't y'all want to go back to Africa? So then, you know, you have Liberia as destination, but then, and in Liberia to date, you know, has these issues around, you know, the African-Americans who had experienced in, you know, slavery and once upon freedom went back there, you know, and sort of the difficulty, you know, between the new immigrants back to Africa and, you know, the indigenous people that never left and that whole power thing. So then you know, in your play, you interrupt that with another wrinkle. It's like, oh, well, let's just make this into a colony where we have, you know, people sentenced to this country. And we're like, oh.
Uh-huh.
So all that stuff, I'm sure, you know, sort of swirling around.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the trickiest things about working on this play was because there was just so much history, and it was hard to decide, like, how much history did I put in, how much context do I give, because it's just so many, you know, just, like, different branches to the tree. So I wanted to paint the whole tree, but that was sort of the tricky thing to really just focus on, like, the character relationships and, you know, just trying to figure out different ways of, you know, getting the history to the audience, you know, like, be it the program or in the lobby or whatever. But the more I was, like, doing research about it and the more, like, all those branches that you just mentioned about Liberia and Atlantic Ocean and migration and, like, all those things, like, it was tricky fitting all that into the play. And I definitely had to make some decisions about what went in and how much of it went in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the toughest thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in your bio, it's written that you were born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas. And
mm-hmm.
you obtained your BA from Brown University and the MFA from the Yale School of Drama's Playwriting Program, which means you are, like, pretty phenomenal.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Kansas City connection and then the Yale connection, like, oh, what a great marriage, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Kansas City's got all that black history. Like, oh, my God. I mean, okay. Particularly performance and musical history. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and also, you know, as I already mentioned that you were in residence at the Magic Theater. Were you working on this particular play or were you doing other things?
Yeah, I was working on this play. One of the stipulations of my residency was to create a new work while I was there. And so this play was the thing that I wrote while I was there. And then I took part in, like, the literary department, and I read a lot of plays by other writers, and I introduced some writers to magic. So it was a really good relationship. It was a really good year. The Bay Area has been really fantastic to me in my work. And, you know, I've worked with Crowded Fire in San Francisco, and ACT in San Francisco, and Berkeley Rep, and I've had this really great long-term relationship with Magic, so I'm really grateful for the support from all the different theaters out here and all the people who come out to see my show. So I'm really excited to sort of share this work and have a world premiere at Magic. So, yeah, it's pretty cool for me as a writer.
Yeah. So I know I saw your play Drip, and I think I saw another one of your plays. So I'm wondering, what other plays of yours have been performed here in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Yeah, well, Drip and Good Goods was a play
happened
a couple of years ago. Yeah. And then I've had readings of a play called Blacktop Sky and Man in Love out of ACT. So I've had a good, I've had a good chunk of my work read out here, so, yeah, pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm very grateful for it, yeah.
Yeah, and another one of your plays is Inked Baby, and, like, you just think about Good, and that was set in a store. And that was about inheritance, too, and in this play you have, you know, you have two generations. You have, you know, Charles Boyd, African-American, man whose son, Jacob Boyd, who's in his 20s, he's also on this ship. And so, but the two plays I've seen of yours, the second one in particular, Good Goods, it was a generational kind of piece. And just wondering sort of your plays, when you write them, like sort of what is your process? Do you do the research? Do all of your plays have a certain? Do you always have your plays have to have a certain kind of component? Just wondering, sort of creatively, how do you come to the work? And then with regards to penmanship, that one had a long trajectory from, because I actually didn't read it. I decided I was going to just save. I just wanted to see it. I don't think I want to read it. So all I have is my stage reading experience, and you said, or I think you told me, it's like, oh, it's so different. I'm like, oh, that's great. Sort of how, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the research and trying to sort of make the work, penmanship specifically, into something that is coherent, because there are so many different places you could go with, given the setting, and given, you know, the various aspects of the set, you know, like being on a ship, like, wow, that could go so many places, but you have to sort of stay focused. I'm just wondering, creatively, does each play have its own genesis insofar as how it comes to you and how it works itself out and how the characters speak to you and give you the information so that you know how to bring them alive?
I think it's pretty much the same for, like, every play that I start, where it just usually starts with a theme or an idea, and it usually gets sparked by reading an article or an essay or, you know, hearing an interview on the radio. And then from there, I just sort of start doing a simple kind of, like, Google search or a JSTOR, like, database library search of different keywords that I'm interested in. And then I find, like, books or, like, broader essay topics, you know, like when penmanship, when I was sitting down to think about it and I knew that I wanted to do the play and have it set on the ship, then it was just like, you know, because I've never been on the ship, I've never been in the ocean, I've stood in it, but I've never been out away from land. So, you know, the first thing for me to do was to sit down and sort of do research about ships. and then the research kind of sprawled from there. I mean, I read chapters of Moby Dick. I read Eugene O'Neill has a lot of ship plays that he wrote early in his career, so I read a lot of those. I listened to a lot of sea shanty kind of music. So the research just takes on different facets and different topics. And then the next step is to try to figure out, okay, well, who are the people in this play? And then what is the play world that they inhabit? And so then I make decisions about what this world is and who the people are and what the relationships are. And then I usually map out the first couple of scenes once I figure out the relationship among the people. And then I just start writing the first scene from there. You know, some playwrights like to outline the whole play before they even start writing a lick of dialogue, but I usually start with the first draft as, like, my outline. So, you know, I just get people talking. I sort of try to figure out the, like, how to make use of the scene, any kind of theatrical devices. So, you know, if I want to have directed dress where the character talks directly to the audience, or if I want to have music in the play, or I only want to do, like, a series of scenes where three people are in it. So yeah, I try to give myself those kind of little devices to work with throughout the play too. So then the first draft is, you know, like essentially the outline, and then the subsequent drafts are just me sort of reworking it and making sure my intention is clear with the audience and, you know, I'm raising the right kind of questions and that kind of relationship. And with penmanship, it was a really... It was unique and a first for me to work with a theater for so long, because I think it's like 2 years now that we worked developing this play, and it was just a series of doing different workshops essentially all over the country, with Magic sort of in the lead. So that was a unique relationship to hear so many different actors. And they were all great. Like, in each one of these workshops, I was working with a different group of actors. So it was great to sort of hear, you know, seven actors play Charles Boyd, you know, in a reading or a workshop. So I had that added gift of then, you know, having actual physical bodies sort of inhabit these characters. So that was a new facet of development for me as well with a penmanship. But, yeah, but usually, yeah, it's just a lot of research in the beginning and then trying to figure out what the play world is and who's in the play world, and then I write the first draft. That's usually what happens.
I thought at first when you said that you had never been on, you know, the ocean in a ship, that the first thing you did was, like, go charter something. And
I know, yeah. I mean, you would think. Well, it's funny because, like, you know, I mean, this is such an awful kind of stereotype, but I actually don't know how to swim. And I'm not, like, afraid of water or anything, but, you know, I have no interest in being in the middle of it.
They have life jump in the water and grab you, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't even want to risk
it. If you fall
overboard. I feel like, yeah. I'm like, I will stick to the shower. That's my plan. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
I want to come back to your awards and honors, but I do want to mention that you're a core writer at the Playwrights Center, and American Theater Magazine selected you as one of 15 up-and-coming artists whose work will be transforming America's stages for decades to come. And when I read that, I thought about August Wilson and how, you know, we certainly need people to step into, you know, the wonderful landscape that he opened for us with his 100 years of Black history and the 10 play cycle. And I certainly see you as, with your work, because it's so epic and so specific, though, you know, each world that you have us inhabit. And these characters are just so interesting. I mean, it's like they're not your neighbor, but you think, wow, it would be so interesting to have a neighbor like that, or maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you to talk about, you know, the current cast, you know, the folks that are embodying these characters that you were able to channel and shape and sort of embody with this wonderful writing, and as well as the director Ryan Gazzo Purcell at the Magic. So if you could talk a little bit about sort of the creative team now, that's sort of helping you like take this work and I'm like, oh my God, give it flesh, and like make it real for you.
Yeah, well, it's been really a joy to work with a group of people who are so gifted and so talented and so passionate and just really smart, And so when you mix all those ingredients together, it just turns out to be a really dynamic, exciting, very fertile place to sort of create art. So having the cast, like Eddie and Tangela and Adrian and Thais, having those group, because it's a small cast. It's only four people in the play that we see. And there are a handful of offstage characters, but we only sort of get to know these four people on stage. And they are just really taking on these characters as complex as they are and finding these nuances and finding ways to find love in the play. Because even though some heavy stuff happens in the play, the actors are doing a really great job of finding the love and the sincerity and the humor in the play and bringing that to these characters and on stage. So it's been a real gift to watch them work and hear them work and see them work, these past couple of weeks. And it's been cool working with Ryan, too. He's just incredibly smart. He works really well with the actors, and he creates community really well in the room, because it's such a small group. And, we are sort of creating this very big play world, like that cast, they have to have each other's back throughout the process. And Ryan's done a really good job of creating that kind of community so that they can all take care of each other and tell the story. So, I feel like it's in good hands with the whole team, from the designers, through the cast and the director and everybody who's working behind the scenes. Like, I feel very well taken care of, and I feel like the play will be really hopefully dynamic and fully realized to its ideal potential. So, it's been pretty cool to just be a part of the process, and I'm glad that I could be out here in San Francisco to, just take part in the process on the ground with them. So, it's a win-win for me,
Right,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And I just think about, Kansas City. I don't know if you all have any water there. Is it landlocked, or do you have, any major water coming through there?
Well, we have river. There's a river, but it's mostly landlocked. Kansas City is known as the city of fountains, so that gives you an indication of what little water we have, a body of water. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So I was wondering, in closing, I want to let everyone know we're speaking to Christina Anderson, who is she is celebrating her return as Magic Theater's 2011 Playwright in Residence. With her world premiere of Penmanship, and the play is directed by Magic Theater's Associate Artistic Director Ryan Gazzo Purcell, and is running May 21st through June 15th, and the Magic Theater is at Fort Mason Center, Building D, third floor in San Francisco, and the run is through June 1st, so you don't want to miss it. And how long are you hanging out here? Are you going to be here for a minute? I know you'll probably be at opening night, but are you here, through the 28th at least?
Yeah. I'll be here until, I think, June 4th. And then the closing of the run is June 15th, so...
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be a good chunk of time for people to check out the show. And we should be scheduling different talkbacks and stuff. So I think people can check out the website, I should be there for up until June 3rd for talkbacks and different things. So you know, if you come early, you get to shake my hand. So that could be a
right, yeah. And bonus, the box office number is 415-441-8822, and you can visit Magic Theater, Magic in the Theater with T-R-E at the end, .org for tickets and information. And they're $5 off for seniors and educators, and student tickets are all $20, so it's pretty reasonable. Preview tickets are just $30, and the highest price is $60. So, you know, it's like, wow, you can find your range and, you know, maybe go at the mid-level and you can, you know, visit often, like at least twice, you know, catch Christina, you know, in the beginning and then go back and see it again. But I wanted you to talk in closing about, oh, we got 1 minute, about you know, sort of being from a place, looking at sort of place. I mean, this is, takes place on a whaling ship and it's on water and you're from a place where, like, you know, you're surrounded by land. It's like, you know, sort of a different kind of energy. And so I have, like, two things. Maybe talk a little bit about sort of place and geography and how what you bring to that is not being from a place where there's water. And then San Francisco is a port city. And then I was thinking about sort of the spirituality around being around the water. I'm thinking about, you know, in Ifa or tradition, you know, we've got Yemanja, who's like the mother of the big water, and then we've got Olokun, who's like the deity of the deep, deep water. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about one or both of those.
Oh, yeah. Geography and place and the concept of cities is a theme that I tackle in all of my plays. I was born and raised in Kansas City, and then I went to my undergrad out in Providence, and I spent most of my time up since 2003, like on the East Coast. So it's been two different ways of sort of existing and living in America. And then I spent a year here in Magic. Geography and space and traveling, migration, the concept of home are a lot of things that I wrestle with all of my plays. Because a playwright or being like a playwright who works a lot, there's a ton of traveling and figuring out different cities and meeting different types of people. So, you know, that whole notion of traveling in place, you just learn a lot about a history of a city in this profession. And then the whole concept of water, you know, my relationship to water, like even though I've never been properly like out into the ocean, you know, I've been to beaches, I've kind of floated up to my waist and there's nothing like it. Like even that little bit that I have, just like the spirituality of it, you know, sort of knowing that we all come from a place of water, you know, water has like a healing power, it's transformative, and that kind of relationship, but also this kind of dark relationship too that a lot of people of color and a lot of oppressed people can also have with the ocean. And it's also just this big, huge natural entity and force. And the power that it can have, as well as like the calming effect that it can have, those were two different things that I was interested in with water and the ocean, working with the play with penmanship. So geography plays a huge part in my body of work, specifically with penmanship. It's about water and ship and the ocean. It's been a really interesting journey working with this play, so to speak, because it is a journey play, but also just in writing it and creating it and writing it in San Francisco has also been really powerful for me. So, that's what I have to say about that in under a minute,
Oh, that was just phenomenal, Christina. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm looking forward to shaking your hand again.
yes. Thank you so much for your support, and I appreciate you coming out to all the shows and, like, letting me on the show and talking about the play, so I appreciate it very much.
All right, you take good care and keep on writing. I'm looking forward to more plays. All right, keep
blessed. Take care. Bye.
Bye. Good morning, Rachel. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. It's great to be back on the show.
Oh, it's good to have you. Rachel Kaplan is the founder and executive director of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, which is returning for its fourth edition, right?
That's right, yeah. We are back for our fourth year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, May 29th through June 4th. It's really exciting. And I want to let you just jump right in before I do your bio, because I started to get at you a little bit late, but that's okay. Yeah, why don't you tell us about this year? Because there's a whole lot in, you know, a whole lot of focus around water.
That's right. We're back. We're a week long festival this year, and for the first time, we're really excited to be at the Roxy Theatre in the Mission. We've got 60 new films this year from 21 countries on a wide range of topics, such as food and oceans, healthy kids, livable cities, many inspiring stories. And our main theme for 2014 is water in the West. It was interesting hearing your previous guest talk about water in other parts of the country. And certainly, you know, as we are facing our worst drought in decades here in California, we've been thinking a lot about that over the last few months, obviously, and it, pulling together many great films, not just about local issues, but films that go around the world and are looking at our very complex relationship with water and how precious that is to us as a resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so why don't you tell us about some of the, I know you have some special programs, some family activities, as well as, you know, really powerful opening and closing and other types of events. Why don't you tell us about some of the highlights, as well as how people can get tickets and some of the venues that you're going to be having the screenings at. And then we're going to be joined by a couple of these directors. Mr. Morrison is actually, I believe, on the air waiting to come into the studio, and so I'll let you two chat a little bit as well.
Yes, we open May 29th. Our opening night film is a film called Damnation, and while we've been looking at water films, water issues this year, we've seen a lot of films about really interesting new movement to remove obsolete dams. There are thousands and thousands of these across the U.S. that we just don't really need in our rivers. And by removing these dams, it completely transforms the rivers, the ecology of the rivers, the economy for people that live near those rivers and watersheds and depend on it, and for wildlife. It's a very positive and inspiring thing that we can do. This film won the Audience Award at the South by Southwest Film Festival. We're very excited to be bringing it here to San Francisco. And the opening night will also be at Aquarium of the Bay, which locals may not be so familiar with, but it's a really interesting aquarium on the waterfront at Pier 39, devoted to bay ecology. You can see many of the animals that live around the bay, but also under the water in the bay. And it's on the waterfront, so it's a perfect setting to launch our festival and be thinking about how important the bay and the watershed is to us. And then, yes, after that, 7 days unfold with films from around the world. We have films by established filmmakers, student films, family films, some tough topics, but also some really great, inspiring stories, and many different ways of types of storytelling. And one of those is actually The Great Flood, which, Bill, are you there?
He'll be in a few seconds.
Okay. So.
Okay. Yeah, Bill, you can. He can speak now.
Yeah, I'm here. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
Hey, Wanda. How are you?
Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. So talk a little bit, Rachel, about how you came to know Bill Morrison's film, The Great Flood. A really beautiful work. It's so. I mean, the cinematic is just so gorgeous, and then the beautiful original score, it's like silent film, but it's a modern, you know, take on that. It's really, really lovely.
So I was fortunate enough to, you know, I've been familiar with Bill's work for some time, and to see this film at another festival. And in this year, yes, thinking about water and thinking about the relationship we have with it when we live near it and around it. This film is such an interesting look at that relationship. It really is inspired by the catastrophic Mississippi River flood of 1927, which displaced over 500,000 people and really caused a significant transformation in American society, and is composed of archive footage, which is fascinating, incredible that this footage exists of this natural disaster that happened in the 20s, and is a really interesting way to tell us the story of this of this event. And Bill, do you want to jump in and tell us a little bit more about how you came to it?
I just wanted to also say that the Flood Control Act of 1928 was a direct result of the Great Flood of 27. That was sweeping legislation that led to a lot of the dams being built that are being referred to in Damnation. So I think it's really great programming to pair these films. But I came to the project really, you know, I go in my work, I go through archives all the time. And at one point I was looking for aerial footages of floods, and I started finding this great stuff and sort of filed in the back of my mind. I used it in a couple of earlier projects. And it wasn't until in the wake of Katrina that I was the John M. Barry's book, Rising Tide, the 1927 Mississippi River flood and how it changed America, was brought to my attention, because a lot of people became interested in the 27 flood after Katrina. Reading that book, I realized that there was, you know, first of all, I knew where these films were, and that it was an incredible topic that sort of spanned the 20th century. And I was also looking for a project to work on with Bill Frisell, and I realized that the implications with African Americans moving from the South into the North was a musical experience that had global significance. And so he would be a really good person to tell that story in his own unique way.
And the music, the film has an absolutely stunning soundtrack, as you mentioned, composed by Bill Frisell. Could you tell us a little bit more about the music in the film and how that sort of came about?
And Bill and I had, first of all, I met Bill maybe 20, 25 years ago when I was a dishwasher in the Village Vanguard, and he would perform there, and I became really enamored with his work and started using his pre-recorded tracks in a couple of short films of mine. After the second one, we sort of realized that we needed to do something from the ground up, and so we were on the lookout for a project that we could work on together when I suggested the subject of the Great Flood to him. It was a great experience working with a composer, very unique for me in that usually a composer will give me something, a MIDI track or a pre-recorded thing, and you know, even though we've been working on something for a long time together, I sort of get this handed this more or less finished piece of music that I then edit to. It's not the way most filmmakers work, but this is my relationship with composers. With Bill being a jazz composer and working with an improvisational band, he writes out some of his musical thoughts on staff paper, and then they pass them around, and then through sound checks and on stage and touring, they develop this music. So I had the great opportunity to go out on the road with these guys while they were building the soundtrack of this, and we had booked a tour that went through the South in the spring of 2011. This would be 3 years ago, at which point the Mississippi River was at historic high levels. So we really all had the experience of sitting on the levee in Vicksburg with the rest of the population, kind of scratching our heads and wondering if the levees were going to hold or not. And, you know, there was a statewide evacuation of the area right around the river. And so it was a really stunning coincidence, but we all got the feeling, this sort of uneasy, creeping feeling of what it's like to be in a town in a levee area where you don't know if it's going to hold or not.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, Bill, you are a New York-based filmmaker, artist, and I was reading that you're best known for your collage film, The Cassia?
Yeah, I say Dekasia, but over in Europe they say Dekasia. That sounds good.
Dekasia. Okay. Yeah, and you are a member of Ridge Theater and the founder of Hypnotic Pictures. You attended Reed College 1983 to 85, and you graduated from Cooper Union School of the Arts in 1989. And you made quite a few films, but you're also a musician. And I was just wondering, sort of as we're looking at this beautiful sort of archival tapestry, which you divide into sections as if it's almost like a symphony or an opera, and it has these different episodes. And then in the episodes, you know, the river plays, the Mississippi River is, definitely the protagonist, you know, in the story. And we see these people being moved. However, at the end of the journey, and all through the journey, you know, there is this beautiful musical score, and within the celebration, there's also sort of a mining of what happens when people are moved, and how you wonder, like, how can someone smile and be happy, but yet you show, like, people, you know, sitting on the levee where they were, you know, the black people where they were moved, and you know, finding room to, like, play the guitar and to sing and to smile and to clap and to find some joy in those moments. I wonder if you could talk about sort of your work in integrating, making it multimedia, multidimensional, artistically to tell stories.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. It's a beautiful description. Just to clarify, I'm not a musician, but I do respond to music, and I work with a lot of composers and musicians all the time. So I'm maybe an honorary musician, but I can't claim that as one of my credits.
Okay.
That story, it's really a tribute to the incredible. I mean, that footage is a tribute to the incredible work that the cameraman on the ground did at the time. It's just remarkable because it must have been just unbelievably hard circumstances with which they are shooting in the rain, on boats, on levees. As you mentioned, a lot of people were under extreme levels of duress, and they're shooting these with big, heavy equipment, 35-millimeter black and white negative, nitrate-based, you know, flammable footage. You name it, it was just an incredibly difficult situation. Yet these people were real artists, and they couldn't have thought that, even though they were working for a news film corporation, they couldn't have thought that everything they were shooting was ever going to make it into a newsreel. So what I've done is mined outtakes, which just go on and on and on. And because of their relationship to the people they were shooting and really the novelty of what they were doing, I'm sure a lot of these people hadn't had a big camera stuck at them. They captured just amazing details and gestures, really nuanced moments of these people's lives. And I think that that's what makes this footage so powerful, is that we all can relate to these people. I mean, they're first of all, they're singularly American. A lot of their gestures, and you mentioned their dancing, and there's something that's so American about these people. And though it's 80-some years ago, it's really something that we can still relate to as people. So I think that there's a great spanning of the divide. There isn't this otherness where you sit and go, well, that happened a long time ago in some place I don't live, and that's nothing that, you know. You're really connecting with these people, especially when their eyes meet the camera's lens. And I think the real story here is a story of strength and perseverance and resiliency, which really has been an enormous part of the African-American experience throughout. The Great Migration is told as a story that began the Civil War. Of course, it gained a lot of steam in World War I when jobs became available in the industrial north, and the Great Flood of 1927 is yet another chapter of it, but it's an important chapter, and especially with the advent of the electric guitar the same year, and how Delta blues was moving into the cities and transforming and becoming a part of R&B and rock and roll, and then becoming really a global music, maybe the global music. It's a really compelling part of this story. So when you mention that final scene, that was shot probably in 1960. You can see somebody holding a poster of John F. Kennedy, so we can imagine it's at an inaugural event or an election event. And it, you know, even though that still is now, you know, 55 years ago or whatever, it speaks to where this went in the future. And so we are really fortunate to have access to this footage and that the people who shot it were so observant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And I wanted to mention to our audience that that your film, The Great Flood, is actually screening at 7 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st at the Little Roxy. So that should be really great. Are you going to be able to make it to the screening?
I'm not going to be able to make it that night, unfortunately, but I hope you all have a great screening. We did bring it to San Francisco a couple years ago as a live event, but this will be its San Francisco premiere as a standalone film with a recording that we made a year ago, and it's just a really tightly edited project now, as opposed to being something that supported a live event. Now the film is the main event, and so it's a premiere of the standalone film.
Oh, wow. So where did you perform it when you all, Bill Frisell was with you and you did it live?
Oh, my God. it was downtown in a civic building, a very prominent theater, but I can't remember the name of it. Maybe you can float a couple of those in. It had a funny name, I thought.
It wasn't Davies or the Herps?
Yeah, that was in the Herps.
Okay.
That downtown right in the Civic Center?
Yeah.
Would be it. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not always up on my San Francisco geography.
Oh, that's okay. Wow. Yeah, because when I first heard the story about the Great Flood, I just immediately just thought about, wow, segregation continues, like, even in a catastrophe. I'm like, wow. That is, like, so amazing, particularly, you know, when one thinks about, you know, Katrina and then the other hurricanes, subsequent hurricanes. And you know, in this particular edition of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, May 29th through June 4th, they are just, I mean, the selection of films, my goodness, that you all have, Rachel, is, I mean, like, people should see them all. Yeah.
Well, we hope many people do. We have many people that come and enjoy, you know, I see them at screening after screening and are really discovering new stories and new ideas, you know, hearing stories from people all over the world in the films that are working on environmental justice, and other with other great challenges, but many of the stories are very inspiring or very thought provoking, and there's always something new to learn. So people do come and see many of the films.
To get tickets, you can go to sfgreenfilmfest.org, or you can email info@sfgreenfilmfest.org, or you can call 415-552-5580. So, Bill, we're joined in the studio now, Rachel and Bill, by Leah and Leah Mahan. Is that how you pronounce it, Leah?
Mahan.
Mahan, thank you. And Derek,
yes.
Evans, I believe. Are you with us, Derek?
I think so.
Okay, yes, you are.
Yeah.
And they're joining us to talk about Turkey Creek. And so that's another aspect, Rachel, about the festival, is that you have directors that call San Francisco Bay Area their homes, like Leah.
That's right. I'm really excited that we'll be presenting Leah's absolutely brilliant new film, which is called Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek. It's been a long time in the making, as Leah can discuss here. And I think just is a really interesting pairing to talk about today with the Great Flood, when we're looking at this part of the world around the Mississippi in the 20s. And then now this really is a story spanning the last decade of people living in a town in coastal Mississippi, and these you know, natural disasters are certainly, like Hurricane Katrina and the subsequent hurricanes, is definitely a part of that story. So I will hand over to Leah and Derek to tell you more.
Okay. All right, sure. And Bill, I don't know if you know Leah and Derek, and I don't know if you know Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek. Do you know their film?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, excellent. I'm sure you will love it because thematically you all are in the same house. Yeah. So I want to thank you, Bill, so much for joining us to talk about your wonderful film, The Great Flood, and know that we are going to celebrate it well here in the San Francisco Bay Area when it has its San Francisco premiere on June 1st at the Little Roxy.
Great. Wanda, thank you so much. And Rachel, great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. So, Rachel, are you gonna turn it over or are you going to stay with us?
I can turn it over. I will. Thanks for having me on the show. Really, excited about this year's lineup. I encourage people to come and explore all the great films, meet with the filmmakers and guests that will be here at the festival. And, Wanda, I'll see you at the movies.
I certainly will. All right. Thank you so much. Bye. So I want to tell you, Leah and Derek, oh, my goodness, the story of your hometown, your ancestral village, Derek, is just simply phenomenal. And, Leah, the way that you you craft, you know, the story is just really it's just so classic and so fitting for the tale, and one can certainly feel the love you have for the story and for Derek, you know, your friend, and the various incarnations of this story. I mean, it starts as one thing and it ends up being another. And Derek, my goodness, you are such a hero.
Maybe. I don't know. There's a lot where I'm from, you know. There's a lot of heroes.
Oh yeah, you are. You are certainly one of many. I certainly agree. And Leah, you capture quite a few of those stories. So why don't we just jump right on in? So why don't we talk first about how you two know each other and sort of what was the initial plan for the project? Because it was first one thing and then other things sort of took over.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much for. It's so great to hear your response to the film. I'll just say that Derek and I met as interns working for the filmmaker Henry Hampton in Boston on the Eyes on the Prize series. I had just graduated from college, and Derek was still in college, and we had mutual friends, and we got to know each other there, working in that incredible context, watching that whole series for public television come together about the civil rights movement. And we knew each other over the years, and Derek told stories about where he was from, and I was always fascinated by the stories. And in 2001, it just finally happened that I was done with the film, and he had a Christmas break from teaching, and we decided to make a trip. And it was also at a time when the development pressures on the Gulf Coast and on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in particular were kind of ramping up, and this place that had been settled by his ancestors after the Civil War, it looked very precarious. It looked like this sprawling city that had grown up around it might really change things for good, and he had been wanting to write a book about it and felt like time was running out, and asked me to come along with my video camera and help to document the oral history of the place, and that was how it started. I don't know if Derek wants to add something about how things began.
That pretty much sums it up. You know, when we were working at Blackside in Boston on Eyes on the Prize, Leah was an aspiring filmmaker, and I was an aspiring historian. And we, you know, Leah, what she said, took an interest in this community that I'm from, Turkey Creek. And it's funny, Leah didn't mention that she had previously worked on a couple of really great documentaries, including one called Holding Ground, about the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston, which was about sort of community self-determination. And she had just, and the film that she just mentioned that she had finished was called Sweet Old Song, which was a really great sort of a biopic and a culturally rich piece about an African-American bluegrass virtuoso in his 90s and the love of his life, his wife, who eventually became his wife. And so she had done these really great films about, one about community development and self-determination in a, you know, disinvested environmental justice hotspot in Boston, and this thing about, you know, African-American art and relationship and love, you know, with the film Sweet Old Song. So when it turns out now in retrospect that when we came home to Turkey Creek in 2001, thereabouts, in a way, Leah's recent film history, you know, as a filmmaker, turned out preparing her very much, I think, in ways that we didn't know for what this story was going to become, which is some kind of a hybrid, I think, between sort of this biopic, is that the word? You know, sort of human interest, human-driven story about family and individuals and relationships, but also about community development and social justice in the context of how communities do or don't fare well as so-called, you know, progress or economic development, you know, moves forward through history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to let the audience know that come hell or high water, the battle for Turkey Creek is screening on Saturday, May 31st at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And I was wondering, Derek, are you going to be coming to San Francisco for the screening there?
You know, I am. I'm actually going to come out to the Bay Area. It's one of my favorite places to regroup. and I usually get out there about once every couple of years. And so I'm going to come out on the 24th, and I'm going to stick around until after the 1st. So I'll definitely be on the Roxy for the screening and for what I'm sure will be a really great follow-up discussion. We've had some really good follow-up discussions after the screening of this film, wherever it's been shown.
Yeah, because there's just so many through lines with regards to themes and concepts that are skeletons that are shaking and doors that are being rattled, you know, as a story of the development of the city of Gulfport is juxtaposed with the displacement of the wetlands that Turkey Creek is really central to, you know, that waterway and just every time, you know, trees are cut down and area cleared, it's almost, I mean, one feels it as if, you know, actually not as if, but one feels the pain of the environment of the landscape, which has a, it actually sort of has a rhythm and an energy like the people. So it's as if it's a genocide. I mean, that's sort of how I felt it as I was watching the film, that the environment it breathes and it lives and it moves and when it's violated, it hurts. You know, there's pain and there's blood and you know, and I guess maybe the way you sort of embody the issues as you know, as the protagonist among many, but you're like the main one. You're the one actually articulating this for us. But it's just so well done.
Yeah, well, that's a testament to Leah's skill and perseverance. You know, it mm-hmm. was about 12 years of doing the best that she could to keep up with me. And I was on a what you might call a learning curve and an action curve like nothing that I ever would have imagined for myself, you know, in my life, being so intense. And that was before Katrina. And then came Katrina, you know, and then came BP. And, you know, that those things, and then the, and what I call the disasters that are continuously occurring between these newsworthy disasters, like the, you know, the bad, like the over-engineering of the area, and not just Turkey Creek, but up and down the Gulf Coast, you know, from coastal Alabama to Texas, really, you know, the constant backroom, good old boy side, you know, dealing with developers and politicians who are well connected with government permitting agencies that the average citizen doesn't even know exists. I didn't know exists, you know. And I got master's degrees and stuff. And I got home and realized that this was like an intense thing. You know, this was like either the Book of Creation or the story of Armageddon, one or the other, you know, or even the Book of Job with all of the issues plaguing this community. And just the mad dash, you know, to try to learn and catch up and keep up with all of this stuff going on. And this is before the disasters, right? I give Lee a lot of credit for being able to keep up with that, because I couldn't keep up with it, and I was doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like, you know, Leah, the way, you know, you have Derek in the classroom when we see him talking to his students about history, and then you mentioned that racism is profitable, Derek, and your students, you know, they're really astute and real cognizant of the interplay between, you know, race and economics and social justice, and then, you know, you invest in the community, you know, where you are. You buy 3 buildings, and then you start a community garden where folks learn the difference between collard greens and weeds, and then you go home, you know, for a visit, and it's like everything's just sort of like the earth shifts. So why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, just, I mean, when I, you know, saw the part about, you know, the disturbance of the cemetery, and I'm like, wow. And I just had to keep on, I'd ask my friend, like, really? Like, they built over the cemetery? Like, what? And just sort of the loveliness of, you know, your 90-year-old, member of the community who is still getting around, you know, it hurts a little bit more, you know, because, you know, she has to use a crutch, but she's still moving, and all these folks that sort of come together. And then, Leah, why don't you talk a little bit about sort of how it was for you, you know, how were you able to, like, hold the camera steady, you know, in the midst of such emotionally, you know, volatile situations, because people are on record, particularly that guy that wanted to he said, oh, there's no wetland here, you know, and then how the people sort of came together, and then you've got mayors saying things that, like, really, like, did you really say that about, you know, the community, and then the whole thing around trying to get the landmark status and historic, what was it that you were trying to get, Derek, with regard,
The federal
historic recognition
as a National Register of Historic Places.
Right, yeah. But I really love that generational connection and how Turkey Creek predates the incorporation of the city of Gulfport. My family is actually in southern Mississippi, so I have relatives in Gulfport and Biloxi and Waveland, and because, yeah, I'm from New Orleans, and so we were in Logtown in Mississippi, and that particular city was taken over by NASA, and so then my people got moved to Pearlington, and so I know that area really intimately, specifically around the disasters, you know, the hurricanes, Hurricane Katrina and the levees breaking in New Orleans and all that. You know, I was like thinking, gosh, I think I've been in that church. yeah, so it's all real personal for me. Hmm?
Yeah, you know, that church has an identical twin sister in Waveland. Hmm. It's called St. Rock. And so you have seen it in Waveland as well. And in fact, my great-grandfather, who's in the film, was the conference treasurer of the, it used to be sort of what they called the African-American jurisdiction of the Methodist Episcopal Church South. And as such, in the 40s, he oversaw the construction of quite a few of these Methodist churches in black communities. And one of the ones, and it architecturally looks exactly like our church, which is Mount Pleasant, is
wow.
St. Rock, which is in Waveland, and which survived Hurricane Katrina. But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that you're from this part of the country because you can actually relate very much to something that I was going to say, which is that Turkey Creek is one of very many communities along that Gulf Coastal Plain from East Texas, coastal Louisiana, coastal Mississippi, coastal Alabama, and even the Florida Panhandle that is a little bit, well significantly, distinct from the rest of the South. You know, it's the coastal, Gulf Coastal South, you know. I often point out that, you know, red beans and rice, more so than black-eyed peas and rice, are the more, you know, the national legume, right? and the fishing cultures, you know, people eat what they catch that day, you know, for lunch and supper. And also, these are places that in many ways have existed outside of other people's time in terms of American history, economic history, cultural history, political history, very much so. These are very kind of analogous to Appalachia, you know, like back up in those hollows and in those places where people who aren't from there don't go that often, right? And so when you go home to Turkey Creek, when you go home to Bayou La Batra, Alabama, when you go home to Waveland, Mississippi, Burlington, these places, they are so, the places that are left, I should say, are so evocative of something very old and resilient and sacred about family and about land and about water and about self-sustenance, right? And there's all these little kindred little spots like that up and down the Gulf Coastal Plain. It's so powerful that, I mean, a story like Come Hell or High Water almost tells itself, like whatever had happened, you know, going forward from when we got home would have actually been a very, I think, very rich and powerful story because these are these kinds of places and people, you know what I mean, and characters and setting. In fact, I don't think there's any accident that we have two African-American women in the last couple of years, one from North Gulfport and the other from DeLisle, which is over by in Hancock County where your folks are, who have respectively won, you know, the National Book Award for Fiction based on a, you know, place-based story at home, and the other is now our Poet Laureate of the United States because of poems that she wrote about the place and the people historically. So it's an amazing place. And, you know, Turkey Creek and the film that Leah has made is singularly important and singularly instructive. But for me, I got to say, I think it's really important both as an educator and just as a person with a soul. I think that this story has a universal and a regional and an American that I think is just very, very instructive and evocative of situations outside of Turkey Creek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leah?
I just wanted to respond to your question also about, you know, holding the camera or kind of getting through these moments where things are either emotional or maddening in some way. And I just wanted to say something specifically about the cemetery and that scene, because that was something that had happened not too long before we made our trip down to Mississippi, that the cemetery where the settlers of the community had been carried was mostly bulldozed. All of the markers that were wooden markers and informal markers had been plowed under, and there were just a few headstones left. And it's kind of a long story about how that happened, but Miss Eva Skinner, who took us there on the trip that you see in the film, her young son was buried there in the 30s. And so she was the cemetery people hadn't been buried there since the 40s, so she was a living person who could actually look at the place and talk to us about what had been there as an eyewitness, you know, someone who actually buried somebody there. And the caretaker of the cemetery, you don't learn this in the film, but Dozier Hines, who talks about the road that was planned through his property, he was the caretaker of the cemetery, and he helped us understand what had happened there. I think what's striking about that moment, you know, that's one of the scenes that took a lot of work. It was hard to figure out how to tell that story. And we went to the cemetery many times and with different groups of people, and that just felt like the most, you know, sort of clear story about what this meant to people. And Miss Eva and Derek were actually very sort of calm and reserved in a way during that moment, and it was afterwards that it sort of became clear how difficult that was for Miss Eva to be there and to see what had happened to the cemetery. And and I just wanted to mention, you know, she's one of my heroes and one of Derek's heroes, I think. I know. And she just passed away just the day before the film was actually on America Reframed on the World Channel, and that was at the end of April, and she just passed away the day before that happened. So part of what's really hard about releasing the film right now is that a lot of the elders that are in the film have passed on. A number of them passed on very soon after Katrina. People survived the storm, but the aftermath was just so hard that a lot of the older people didn't survive long after that. And so, you know, it feels both good that we captured their stories on some level, but also, you know, very hard that they aren't here to see the finished film. And just on that note of how I filmed moments like that, I'll give an example of a more lighthearted moment where there's a moment in the film where Derek and I went out on the creek with Rip Daniels, who's a cousin of Derek's, who owns the local black radio station in Gulfport, and they went out on the creek to do a live radio show. And in the process, we were in a kind of remote, the far end of the creek, and in a place that's wooded and not much foot traffic or regular traffic. And somehow the season when all the snakes were out, and there were snakes everywhere on every bank. And it was both a funny and terrifying moment. And I think somehow in moments like that, I'm looking through the viewfinder and I somehow remove myself and I think, this is happening, this is a film, this is happening on screen, this is not really happening. But I think somehow to do this kind of work, you do have to have that place in yourself where you're, you know, separating yourself and trying to see something objectively. And but it's difficult. It's very hard to do, particularly with the interview you mentioned with Butch Ward, who was the developer who proposed filling in a lot of the wetlands in Turkey Creek. And, you know, he sort of flat out said in front of the camera that he doesn't think that there are any wetlands there. and it's kind of amazing, some of the language and the things that people we're willing to say in front of the camera. And you just have to kind of, you know, get through those moments and think later about what you're going to do with them.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of what I was talking about earlier when I said, you know, these places that exist outside of time, you know, or other people's experience. I mean, most people don't come from a place where the local politicians sound as ignorant and crazy, okay, as these folks do on this film and do every day in real life, talking about public matters, you know, or a developer flatly saying, you know, that some wetlands that are designated repeatedly everywhere by multiple government agencies as wetlands aren't wetlands to him, you know. And even like with the snakes, you know, the water moccasins in May. You know, if you're not from the deep Gulf South, I mean, you probably will never see something like that in your life, you know, during that first week of May. But like I said, Leah was always there, you know, at the right time, you know, to catch these unexpected. You couldn't write this. You couldn't script this. You would have to just do what she did. What we did was live it, gather it, collect it, and then weave it into something because it's really a lot of rich stuff, you know. It's really rich. It's too rich in some instances.
Mhm. Yeah. I mean, there are some real like intense moments of like when you are driving back from Boston, going back home to see, you know, which you're, you know, loaded up with bleach and other types of supplies, you know, after Katrina hits, you don't know what to expect, and it's just as bad as you probably could have expected, and then worse. I mean, particularly when you find out, you know, that your parents, they hadn't evacuated because your father is in a wheelchair, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. The Army Corps came
by
his house the night before, like 11 o'clock, and told him, you know, they wrote his Social Security number on his wrist so that, you know, if he didn't make it, they would be able to identify him, you know. And I mean, the whole – and then I got this cousin. I mean, there's so many stories. This at one point was in the film, but, you know, 21 people in Turkey Creek were saved from drowning by my cousin Sean and other young men from the community who went out. They found my boat, my little John boat, which didn't have a plug in it. So they took a pine cone and stuck a pine cone so that the boat would float. And they went down the street that was full of water and like little white water rapids with like stop signs and railway crossing signs flying around in the air like razor blades, and went through all of that to get those people, you know, out of the houses on the lower end of Rippey Road near the creek, you know, including my mother. They were floated out on an air mattress by it fortunately, thank God, had a two-story brick home that they could swim them to across the street. So, you know, it's the miracles and the heroes and the bizarre, you know, the forces of nature and man that converged in this place is really something, you know, just really something to behold, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was, you know, sort of looking at or, you know, the section of the film that, you know, okay, people survived, but then after, you know, they survived Katrina, just sort of the emotional stress of that, you know, people were like, I know my family, people were dying really like within that year and the year after just from the stress, and people's blood pressure was really high after that. And I remember, you know, I had relatives that were floating down, you know, down the street and folks, you know, young people getting in boats and rescuing people. And then I know one of my older cousins, he hang on to a tree, and then he grabbed another cousin who was floating by and held on to him, like, for hours and hours and hours until the water went down. So, yeah, you know, those stories, I mean, they still resonate, you know, as policies haven't changed much and people are still displaced, you know, because of, you know, the hurricanes. But I wanted to know if you could talk also, because I know we're going over and I know you're probably busy, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of the development, the casinos and the airport expansion. I remember going to the Gulfport Airport right after Katrina, and I'm like, really, like planes are going to fly out of this? Because they're like, they were walls missing in the airport. I'm like, It was like under construction, but it was being operated. I'm like, it was just really, it was kind of surreal. And then thinking about all the piney wood trees that had fallen, and they were still in certain areas looking like sort of overturned toothpicks, but they're trees. So that kind of landscape. And then I was also wondering if you could talk about sort of the activism and your connecting with the organization, the environmental organization that you connected with, Derek, and then the work you did around sort of organized community to establish the Green Beltway, and then your road trip with the FEMA trailer, that was really interesting. And then I was wondering if you think we can come up tonight today and what's going on there now.
Sure. Well, you know, what was interesting at the time of Katrina was that what happened in New Orleans, which was entirely caused by man, it was caused by the Army Corps of Engineers, which has historically been our main problem in Turkey Creek and across coastal Mississippi as well. You know, they're the ones who built all the dams and levees that your previous guest was talking about, the Army Corps of Engineers. And as far as I'm concerned, they're the only federal agency that's actually, I think, is guilty of murder because of leaving those people in the Lower Ninth Ward vulnerable with that so-called levee that breached in New Orleans during Katrina, which, had it been properly built, wouldn't have. And you wouldn't have, you know, had all of that tragedy in New Orleans. But because of the huge tragedy that occurred in New Orleans, the world never to this day understood or noticed or realized that ground zero of Hurricane Katrina was Pearlington, Mississippi, where your people are. That's where the eye of that storm made landfall, which means everything to the east of that, not the west, and New Orleans is to the west, everything to the east of that, all the way over into Mobile, Alabama, and beyond, was hit with a 30-foot, 25-foot, 20-foot tidal wave, not a flood that rises up, and then leaves mold in your house. I'm talking about a horizontal punch from the ocean that brings in a tsunami. And what it doesn't knock down coming in, it sucks down going out. That's what rolled into Turkey Creek and these coastal Mississippi communities. And when this happened, I was thinking, okay, in a matter of days, in a matter of weeks, people are going to realize that Mississippi has been hit this hard, that 70,000 units of housing have been destroyed. But it didn't happen. And I was wondering, well, why? You know, where are all of the social scientists, the journalists, the government people, the Martians, you know, anybody, you know, paying attention to Mississippi, or if even for that matter, coastal Alabama, you know? And I couldn't figure out why. But now I know why. It was because our governors and elected leaders at the time, just like, you know, the same ones right now that are corroborating BP's lie that the Gulf is clean so that they can get the payoff, shut up, hush money from BP for other things that they want to do on land, you know, casinos, highways, infrastructure development, and all of that, right? That's what they were doing then. Governor Haley Barbour, in particular, former chairman of the Republican National Committee and one of the most Machiavellian, brilliant, bad actors, in my opinion, in modern American political history, he kept his mouth hush about how hard Mississippi was hit because he wanted no lights on Mississippi so that he could do what he did, which was to reappropriate, misappropriate, divert massive amounts of federal recovery dollars, okay, without much attention or whatever from the outside world. Because you know the outside world, when it gets on Mississippi, it gets on Mississippi. Because Mississippi has been responsible for some stuff, right, over the years. So they didn't want that attention. He wanted the money, okay? He took the money, And in the poorest state in the United States, Mississippi, with 70,000 units of housing destroyed, most of them poor people, elderly people, what have you, this guy actually decided after within 2 years that he could no longer find any poor people, okay, whose houses had been damaged. In the 45 counties that have been declared a national disaster area, which is a third of the state, the poorest state in the country, that needed housing recovery money that had been appropriated by Congress for that purpose, and that he wants to divert $600 million of the remaining balance to expand the state port, you know, at Gulfport, which is due south of Turkey Creek, about 3 miles. You know, Turkey Creek is not only historic, but it is geographically ground zero of the future of economic or transportation infrastructure development for that state, and a major port in that region. And so that's why there wasn't much attention paid to Mississippi, frankly. The governor and the rest of them didn't want it. And as you see in the film, you know, they through tax credits, through CDBG grants and all kinds of stuff, this guy even tried to get the Army Corps to issue a sweeping regional permit that would allow developers, listen to this, after Katrina, proved how far inland surge water, hurricane water could come, to change the law and give a permit where people could fill in 5 acres of wetlands without an individual permit, public notice. And this guy wanted, they used the disaster like they often do, to accelerate and do more of the same now that there's more money to do so. And the same thing's happening now in the aftermath of BP. And it happens in this part of the country. And this is one of the reasons why the story of Turkey Creek is so important for people to look at from multiple angles, because one of the probably most important angles you can look at this going forward is, you know, these communities in coastal Louisiana that used to be on dry land but are now sitting in water because of Army Corps and energy companies and others being allowed to over-engineer the environment and put canals through wetlands where they don't belong, or to pour concrete in Mississippi or Alabama in wetlands where they don't belong, or to put, you know, tar sand carrying pipelines under aquifers and water supplies where they don't belong. This is wrong. You know, this is wrong. This is, and nobody knows about it. You know, they come down, Anderson Cooper and the rest of them, they come down for a couple of weeks, you know, and talk about, you know, the region. And we're getting tired of getting called resilient, I got to say. You know, you hear that all the time. The Gulf Coast and the people are so resilient. Well, that's beyond getting taken advantage of and abused. Yeah, I agree that these are strong people. You know, slow to anger, you know, slow to blame somebody else for their problems, self-reliant, self-resilient people who are used to getting up, like Miss Eva Skinner, you know, and others, Mr. Doja Hines, and taking care of their business and surviving. Okay, but that cultural trait has been turned against us and used as camouflage, really, for what government and private sector and everybody is not doing to actually make us more resilient or keep us resilient, but to make us not resilient, you know, unable to weather the next thing. And that's what's happening, I'm telling you, with everybody who's listening, everybody who's not listening, with billions and billions and billions of your federal tax dollars are being invested as I speak, whether it's from BP's Clean Water Act funds or what's left of the Katrina recovery money or what's left of your federal income taxes that make their way to these states. These dollars are being invested to make the most vulnerable communities, the brownest communities, the most responsible stewards of the environment that have ever lived there, make them less resilient and eliminate them. And that was the blueprint and that was the plan for Turkey Creek before Katrina and the rest of them before Katrina. It was the plan after Katrina when they knew, you know, once this kind of recovery money, it's like I had a blueprint already. Once this kind of recovery money comes in for something, we got a plan or a blueprint of how to do it to build, you know, state or regional economic development projects, like big projects, like ports and highways and big stuff like that. That it's not recovery. It's not rebuilding anything. It's building new stuff at the expense of other people coming back, and sometimes even on top of them, just like the apartment buildings on top of the community. That's business as usual, and a disaster makes it nothing but worse. And when everyone's gone thinking the disaster is over because, you know, Superstorm Sandy hit the East Coast or some famous person in Hollywood got married and everybody leaves, they don't understand that the real disaster is what happens in the interim with those federal dollars and resources that weren't there for those people to mess over folk with beforehand. And so that's exactly what has happened, you know, in this region. And it goes all the way up to today. Just yesterday, the Senate passed a law that was written, you know, it looks like it's for everybody's benefit, but it's primarily written, a piece of it, by the state senators from Mississippi to provide a regulatory shortcut for them to deepen the Mississippi Sound, you know, the like the water, okay, mm-hmm. south of the beach, so that they can go ahead and expand that port and send more trucks, more rail, more diesel, more exhaust, more fumes right up our nose in Turkey Creek and North Gulfport, you know, in the name of economic development. When people are still not recovered from these man-made natural disasters.
Yeah, I noticed on the website that actually some of the funds are going to some projects that you all are connected to. I was wondering if you could talk about like, are you in Boston again, Derek? Are you in Turkey Creek? Where are you located now, and what is the form, what is the shape of your activism today, and for you, I was wondering, because this is more than a film, and it seems like, you know, as far as your projects go, you know, what you do is more than filmmaking. You sort of start movements or become a part of a movement because you actually make it visible in a way that film, sort of tells stories that, I mean, you can hear it, you can read it, but then if you see it in the way that a good storyteller can frame it, which, and you are a very good storyteller, you want to do something. So I'm sure... there are people that see the films like, okay, where can I sign up? Where can I go? Who can I write? So you can talk about sort of the film as a vehicle for social change.
Yeah, and I've been wanting to say something connected to that. That's about the fact that, you know, Derek said that this is very much an American story, and we found a way over the years. The film took a dozen years to make, but in the meantime, after Katrina, we actually created something that still exists and is growing strong, called Bridge the Gulf, which is a community media project to help many communities facing a lot of the same issues on the Gulf Coast, to help them tell their stories, because Turkey Creek, I became so aware after Katrina that, Turkey Creek's story is rich and unique in many ways, but there are so many Turkey Creeks across the Gulf Coast and so many cultures, diverse cultures that have been there for a long time, the Cajun cultures and Native American cultures, but also the new arrivals, the Vietnamese fishermen, and all of these communities were facing a lot of the issues that Turkey Creek had been facing for a long time suddenly after Katrina. And so what Derek had learned, and along with others like Rose Johnson in Mississippi, suddenly became so relevant. I mean, it had been relevant, but people didn't know how relevant it was until after Katrina, because Turkey Creek had won some battles and had found some success and some ways of organizing and working with national partners. And so we wanted to find a way to share that story and also help all these other communities to tell their stories. So Bridge the Gulf has existed since 2010. It just so happened that it launched just as the BP disaster was unfolding. We had originally thought about it as something to try to get media and, you know, funder attention back to the Gulf Coast because the recovery was very much unfinished. And then the BP disaster happened, so Bridge the Gulf became very much a response to BP, a way for people to respond and to have a voice outside of the mainstream media. And the mainstream media has really sought it out as a source a number of times in important ways. So Bridge the Gulf is very much something that both Derek and I have helped to build and something that we see as a vehicle for people to learn more about the Gulf Coast and the context and a lot of, you know, grassroots-based community organizations that are working on issues of environmental justice and ongoing recovery around the BP disaster. And so that's one big part of what happened after the film ends is that that's part of what Derek and I both went on to do. Also, the film is being used around the country, and this is just starting that a number of we have a lot of networks, mainly through Derek's activism. And for instance, the Moving Forward Network is a group of environmental justice groups dealing with the growth of ports and infrastructure in minority communities around the country. So like Gulfport, there are communities in Mobile, Alabama, Long Beach, California, Oakland, California, where that are dealing with a lot of the same public health issues and development issues around you know, transportation and ports, and, you know, often when these big projects are built, they're built in minority communities. And so we had a couple of great events in April in Mobile and Long Beach where these communities were showing the film and discussing it and using it as a way to draw attention to what's happening in their communities and drawing connections between this story and their story. And we're going to be doing a lot more of that. And I'm talking to some groups in Oakland about planning something probably either this summer or fall. Hopefully it'll happen this summer.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Derek, how is Turkey Creek today? How are the people doing? How is the preservation of what is left of the environment, I mean, sort of, you know, there was some victories, and I was wondering, and then Katrina happened, and so there was a different type of emergency, and then BP happened, and that particular recovery won't be seen for a few lifetimes, no matter what it looks like on the surface. And so I was wondering sort of what do things look like now, and how is your health?
Thanks for asking. Turkey Creek, I should say, you know, the story's not over. I would not call it a success story, for one reason being that too much has been lost already, you know, that can never be regained. But there have been victories, and some of which we're waiting to see if they are, in fact, substantial or significant or sufficient. You know, it's ongoing. It continues. It's still, like I said, ground zero. It's like the Gaza Strip or something, you know, of the Gulf Coast there, where the community and the birds and the fish and the environment, and I believe God Almighty and democracy, have one vision for what is healthy, just, and sustainable in this very small area of land, right, in coastal Mississippi. And the Port Authority and the governor and the United States senators who represent Mississippi in the Congress and the big development interests have a different vision for the very same small little chessboard that, thank God, this film has now put out to the world, right, as a place that exists, a place where battle lines are drawn and clear, and where, you know, it's kind of like Selma, you know, in 1965, or Montgomery in the late 50s. It's like, this is it. You know, this is where we are. This is the battle lines, and we're waiting to see, you know, how the dust is going to settle. Also, for me, one of the important ways to help make sure that the battle for Turkey Creek is as successful in the long run as it can be, I think it is important to connect it to a larger narrative, to a larger framework in which, just like in the 60s, there was more than one Selma. It's just Selma was the place that happened to be the place that dramatized the need, you know, for the Voting Rights Act. You know, there was more than one Montgomery that had segregated busing, but Montgomery was the place where, you know, Dr. King and others happened to be to provide, you know, a dramatic lens into what was going on, you know, pandemically across the South. And so I think of Turkey Creek, and I think of the Lower Ninth Ward today, and I think of Africatown over in Mobile County. And these other places, I think of the United Home of Nation down on coastal Louisiana and the Elder John Charles community down there and others, as the Selmas and the Montgomerys and the different places of what ought to be, I hope will soon continue to be, a 21st century iteration of a civil and human rights and environmental justice movement that will, like the civil rights movement, not only take care of business at home in Turkey Creek and the Gulf region, but I believe teach people in the United States and around the world some new ways of thinking and doing. Because we don't live in a time anymore where we can separate our conversation about clean water from our conversation about fair and affordable housing or quality schools, right, or, you know, of these other issues. These are holistic issues that are connected naturally. Even whether universities, nonprofits, or government agencies want to deal with them, you know, as connected or not, they are, because that's the way life and reality is, right? Things are connected. And we've been forced by circumstance to deal with these things, as overwhelming as it is, in a holistic and connected way. And for me, the only way to bear that, to survive that as a person who has a finite number of breaths to take in this lifetime, okay, is to really throw it up there as being, as I said, connected and corroborating and validating of other related communities, stories, and people, you know what I mean? So that hopefully, just like in the civil rights era or what have you, a critical mass of people will say, you know what, it's not just about Turkey Creek. Enough of this stuff right here being the norm in places where this should not be going on. And that's what I'm hoping will happen. That would be a success.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking, as you were speaking, both of you, Leah and Derek, was that this is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Summer, and there's going to be a whole lot. There's a new movie that has just come out about those young people that went from the north to the south to team up with activists there to register people to vote, and then the new party that was developed when the Democratic and Republican Party couldn't hold it, the one that Fannie Lou Hamer represented, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of
the Freedom Democratic Party?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I just thought this is all, you know, the film and the movement that you all started, which is in concert with other movements that have been perhaps not as active but are sort of regaining their steam, because things are not necessarily getting better around respect for environment and for indigenous lands, you know, and sort of the sanctity of one's burial grounds, you know, sacred burial grounds that have been interrupted historically since the founding of this country, or the stealing of this country from the indigenous people. So it just continues and continues. Like you mentioned, Derek, that, you know, it's a tapestry, you know, where, there are a lot of different stories meeting around, you know, come hell or high water, the battle for Turkey Creek, that this is just another one of those stories. But it just so happens that, you know, we have this wonderful film that, you know, that you and Leah have made, so that we can articulate it a lot better, because we have all these people and these players and these issues like all in one particular document, which makes it easier than, you know, sort of going to gather all this stuff together.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I was wondering, in closing, Leah, you can have some final words of reflection, but I was wondering also, Derek, if you could just maybe just talk a little bit, because I just love the story of how these black folks got this land before there was a Gulfport, you know? And I just wonder if you could just tell us the story again. I know people are going to see it on film, but I just love that story of self-determination.
Yeah, Leah, who goes first?
Okay, well, I guess just what I would like to say is just I'm really excited about showing the film here in the Bay Area. I grew up here in Oakland and lived for a long time on the East Coast and made this film in Mississippi, and people here have been hearing me talk about it for, I guess it's going on 13 years now. So it's really exciting to bring it home for me. And we have a lot of partners and allies here in the Bay Area. There's going to be a great panel discussion with Judy Hatcher, who used to run the Environmental Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and Julian Mosheen McQueen with Green for All. So these are people who are going to really be able to make the connections to this, how this story relates both locally and nationally. And also Daniel Isofano, who is here in the Bay Area. He's an urban planner, and his company worked, I believe they started Derek before Katrina, but after Katrina they help the community to guide them through creating their own plan for revitalizing, rebuilding the community that has been an incredibly important part of their, you know, staking a claim and saying, you know, we're not going anywhere and this is how we envision staying and revitalizing the Turkey Creek and the North Gulfport community that are in that watershed. So these are people who have a lot of knowledge, including, you know, having Derek here is going to be great. So I'm really thankful to the San Francisco Green Film Festival for doing this, and we're really excited about doing this on the 31st.
And I want to mention that that's on Saturday, May 31st, at the Roxy Theater, and the screening is at 7 p.m. of Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek. So that's going to really be exciting.
Yeah. About the land, you know, what's really interesting, some of this is not in the film. Prior to the Civil War, really, when Mississippi became a state in 1818, the land where my community of Turkey Creek is located was actually within the boundary of Mississippi, but like other flood-prone land that would spend a significant amount of time, you know, underwater either from rain events or hurricanes or tidal influence or whatever, it was not part of the state of Mississippi. It was U.S. Department of the Interior, and this was the case all over the country before the dams and the levees that were mentioned in your previous segment. Were built to control these waterways and to create permanently, quote-unquote, dry or arable or developable land, right, in the Mississippi River Basin in 31 states, you know. And so Section 22 of Range 7 East Town, you know, Township 11 in Mississippi was, you couldn't buy it or sell it. It was federal land held by the Department of the Interior in trust for the American people, just like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or something, right? But a Swamp Act was passed in 1849 by our then United States Senator, who would then become the President of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis, who was a Mississippi River plantation owner who, like his, all of that really fertile land up in the Delta and on the Arkansas and Louisiana side of the river to be available for cotton planters to grow cotton without fear of periodic flooding and economic loss. And that's how they got the Army Corps to build those levees up and down that river and others and the man-made dams and reservoirs that you find up in the Delta. Well, down on the Gulf Coast, when the, you know, you got to understand, this is at the same time, the 1840s, that these same guys were driving U.S. national policy to wage war with Mexico to grab the Southwest, you know, so there'd be more land for plantation. And, you know, California, 1849, Texas. So on Turkey Creek, during this time of American expansion for more land for cotton, in particular in agriculture, the land wasn't suitable for plantation agriculture. It never really made it into the state or the county land records because they didn't want it until 18 months before the Civil War started. The state of Mississippi finally signed over for it after the Swamp Act had been passed years earlier. And so when the war happened, nobody was settling nothing nowhere. They would fight. When the war ended, nobody had lived there, but the land was available for development. And so my ancestors, I descend from four of the original eight newly freed African-American settlers who came in and purchased 80 acres apiece of this virgin coastal land, forest, that was had this really almost Garden of Eden-like, both brackish and freshwater creek or bayou flowing through it. And on that land for seven generations, you know, we've lived and developed our own institutions and folkways and way of life, and we're there. That started in 1866, right, the first year after the war was over and they were free to own land and to build schools and to attend schools, and they did all of that. And they even, you know, as you probably know at that time, Mississippi elected not one but two African-American men to represent that state in the United States Senate. So that was called the Reconstruction. And so Turkey Creek was a Reconstruction community, the Reconstruction of the South after the Civil War. And I'm a sixth-generation descendant of the Bentons and the Evanses who settled in Turkey Creek in 1866. And I certainly have no intention of being the generation that loses what they started and what had been, you know, a vibrant community. I mean, in my childhood, there was no better place on earth to grow up than in Turkey Creek, you know. And, you know, Gulfport, which is 30-some-odd years younger than Turkey Creek, which it now surrounds, like Rome surrounds the Vatican, you know, that's where we are. We are at ground zero of, like I said, the future of not only our own community and environment and families, but also really that city and that part of Mississippi's future, particularly where all the state highways, the interstate, and the airport, and ports, seaports, are all located within, you know, a 3-mile radius or less of where we are. We're not near it. We're in the middle of it, inside it, like a hole of a donut. So, and you know, in fact, that airport that you mentioned going to after Katrina, that's in Turkey Creek. That land, that airport is built on, once belonged to my family.
Wow. Yeah, really great lesson of come hell or high water. The battle for Turkey Creek is that, you know, you don't give up, that you have to resist, that you have to fight. But more importantly, the government is sneaky. So you can't you have to stay vigilant. You've got to keep watching because, you know, you turn your head and, you know, trees are cut down and clay is laid down over the earth, and which means it can't breathe, and, you know, buildings are going up and your sacred burial grounds are being, you know, sort of